Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is Jennifer Ait Lee, an author and New York Times reporter. Jenny, welcome to Profiles.
I'm excited to be here.
Let's start with a question that everybody asks, and it wouldn't be a normal interview without it. Where does the eight come from?
Eight means prosperity in Chinese, and Chinese culture obsesses with the number eight. If you remember, the Olympics started on 08-08-08 at 8, I think 08 p.m. And so I was actually born without a middle name, which was a great combination given that Jennifer is the number one name for girls born in the decade of the 70s. And Lee is obviously one of the most popular last names in China, if not the world. So Jennifer Lee was a disaster of a combination. Actually, coming to a lot of universities, when I fill out like forms, they prefer having the eight because it differentiates me from all the other Jennifer Lees, which are in their payment systems and stuff. So basically, when I was a teenager, I decided I needed a middle name. And I just sort of kind of thought like what it could be. And I had a mathematical background and my dad has a PhD in math. And so eight was this combination of mathiness and Chineseness and it's a beautiful number. And so I picked it.
Does it sometimes make your life easier?
Yes. I will say in Jenny Ait Lee is never taken as an account on Gmail or Yahoo or AIM or anything. So I know a lot of people now, because the internet has basically squished us into one community. They put numbers at the end of their username. Oftentimes it's the year they were born. Sometimes it's a three-digit number. It'll be their birth date. But Jenny Ait Lee, I say, has never taken. So I definitely advise people putting the numbers more in the middle as opposed to at the end. So I have a very consistent username across everything.
There must be also some occasions when it makes it harder.
Well, yes, because a lot of databases are not programmed to take numeric characters in their middle name field. So sometimes I have to spell it out. And then it becomes abbreviated and it just becomes E, which is kind of annoying.
Your ethnicity, if one looks on the internet, is not quite clear. Some places refer to you as Fujianese after Fujian province.
Oh, really? I didn't even realize they had found that.
And I guess from Kamoi originally, some people say from Taiwan, some people say Chinese. How do you define yourself?
I say I am Chinese-ish. Basically, or sometimes if I'm asked, so where are you from? And I say, I'm from New York. And they're like, no, where are you really from? And I'm like, I'm really from New York. I was born, raised there and, live there now. I couldn't be more from anywhere else on this planet. I know what they're getting at. So I'll sometimes say I'm genetically Chinese. And my parents are from an island off of the coast of China called Kamoi or Kingmen or Jingmen. It's various names depending on the dialect.
Many Americans of a certain generation remember the bombing of Kamoi and Matsu.
Kamoi and Matsu. So my parents lived through that. As a matter of fact, there are little things from their life that reflect, that experience. Because one, which is you couldn't study at night because of the electricity had to be off. Otherwise, you would guide planes. So they would study by moonlight or by candlelight. And as a result, a lot of them, both my parents wear glasses, and so do I, but for other reasons. And they went to college in Taiwan. So I'm always very careful where my language. I'm like, oh, my parents immigrated from Taiwan, which is technically true because that's where they went to college. And then they came to the United States, but they are from Kamoi or Kingmen or Jingmen. And there was actually a section in my book that talked about being from this island, which is sort of like the DMZ used to be the DMZ of China, because it's about 2 miles off, or maybe 2 kilometers. I mean, it's really just off the border of the sort of the Chinese mainland, but it belonged to Taiwan. And so it was where the nationalists in the retreat from, the big civil war, it was the thing that held. And if that had fallen, supposedly Taiwan would have fallen too. This is my understanding of it. And my parents were born in 1949, same year actually as all the big revolution. And I don't really identify so much as Fujianese, even though Kingmen is part of the Fujian province. I think partially because even though it's technically part of the Fujian province, it belongs to Taiwan. So it has this split identity. And as a result of kind of being Taiwan, but spending a lot of time in China and studying there, I just sort of have this larger Chinese identity. And actually what's interesting is in Chinese language, there is a word that refers to Chineseness that sort of transcends the nation state of China or Taiwan or Hong Kong. And it's Hua, You know, so Hua Qiao means overseas Chinese, or Hua Yi means descendants of people who are Chinese. And it's a really interesting sense of genetic identity that you can be Hua even like if you were born in Peru, you're like third generation, you speak Spanish, you've never stepped foot on, you know, the other side of the globe, they'll still consider you Hua. And it's such a powerful sort of sense of identity, in part because, you know, there's a sense of Chineseness that sort of perpetuates through history, despite the rise and fall of dynasties and governments. And, you know, a great example is the Chinatowns in San Francisco and New York have been around for three changes. It's either three governments or three changes of governments in China. So they've sort of been, you know, kind of riding whatever kind of transitions have been happening elsewhere. And as a result, you know, I identify myself as Hua because there's no sense of passport holdingness attached to it. But in English, I'll just say, oh, I'm Chinese-ish sometimes.
You grew up in New York City as part of a Chinese family then. What mm-hmm. was that like?
The first thing is like growing up in New York, right? If you grew up in New York when you're a little kid, that is your sense of standard, right? You think, you know, like my mom doesn't have a driver's license still. She's like 60. Everyone lives in tall buildings. And it's only when you get older and you go see the rest of the United States, you're like, oh, my God, we're the freaks, right? New York is the one where most people live in apartments instead of in houses. People take mass transit. So that's just sort of interesting. It's almost so cosmopolitan that it's provincial in a way, right? Because if you think the rest of the world is like New York in terms of the interaction with the races, you know, every day on the, you know, on the subway and just in normal workplace settings, and then also the idea of just the cultures and the languages that you just have, literally, you know, kind of hands length or arm's length sort of your arm's length distance from, it's really quite astounding. You know, at the same time, it's a great place to send kids to school if you are rich or they are smart, but otherwise it can be very difficult. And growing up Chinese in the 90s, so I was growing up basically in the 70s, sort of very, very late 70s, and then the 80s. I'm part of sort of the late, early part of the children of people who came after the 1965 immigration reform, which is often referred to as the Open Door Act. And it's really fascinating, right? Because that immigration act basically shifted the balance of immigrants from basically being European-centric to, you know, places in the world where people are more colorful, I guess. And a lot of the people who came over, including my father, came here for graduate school because they got, you know, a series of visas that basically said if you are smart and can be productive, you can come work in the United States. So I can see myself also reflected now in kids, you know, 10, 15 years younger than me, or even, you know, 20 years younger than me. And it's fascinating to see the fact that their parents are basically my parents echoed by 10 or 15 years. So my parents are of a generation of Chinese immigrants who are very educated and thus very proud of their culture. So I grew up in, you know, a community where we, you know, went to Chinese school. It was, you know, good if you spoke Chinese because, you know, it showed that, oh, you're jia jiao hen hao, which means like, oh, you were well brought up if your manners are good and you speak Chinese, right? So it's sort of a reflection of your household, how well you speak Chinese. You know, went to Chinese course, we did Chinese dance, my brother took martial arts, I took martial arts. And so there was a pride in your cultural heritage, in part maybe because of the socioeconomic class of the immigrants that came over, and also because of maybe the sense of connection as a result of, you know, travel and telecommunications. So it's a very different process from maybe Chinese American women who grew up in the 60s. You know, Amy Tan sometimes writes about how, you know, she would put clothespins on her nose in order to make it more pointy, like a Western nose, you know, and, you know, people who are very, like, uncomfortable with the fact that they don't have, quote, double eyelids. And they would try to speak English, you know, all the time. So there is this very interesting kind of divide. And I'm really proud and happy to have grown up in a culture where you can combine, you know, your Americanness with your Chineseness and not necessarily feel like this sort of, you know, sacrifice.
What role does language play in this? You were, I guess, raised primarily as Chinese speaker.
So my first language is interesting. So my first language was Chinese. So you pop out, mom and dad speak Chinese, all their graduate school friends speak Chinese. And so my, you know, for the first 4 years of my life, I spoke Chinese. And it's funny because I listened to some tapes from me when I was like little, and I speak English with a Chinese accent. And I'm like, 1 + 1 = 2. You know, 2 + 2 = 4. You know, and it's this weird kind of thing to hear myself with that. Then came, you know, school, and then you're going to American school 5 days a week. You know, I learned a lot of English from Sesame Street, but there are certain words that they don't teach you on Sesame Street, so you don't know until you get to school. Like, naked was a word I didn't know, and pregnant was a word I didn't know. I remember distinctly, distinctly having to learn those words from my classmates. But you're going to Chinese school like 3 hours once a week, right? And you're kind of speaking at home. But then you kind of have this really interesting, narrow vocabulary of things around the home, which is very different from, obviously, the kind of vocabulary you eventually get if you were to, say, take Chinese in college, which I eventually did. So in college, our vocabulary sort of lessons were full of things, since it was very sort of centered on, you know, Chinese policy and Chinese whatever. We learned words like abortion, revolutionary, proletariat, capitalist. And so it's a very economic kind of focused curriculum, whereas at home you know words like washing machine and, you know, dishwasher and, you know, please take out the garbage and, you know, all these words around clothes and schooling that don't necessarily come up in a sort of classroom-centered curriculum. And it's interesting. So eventually you kind of get all holistic in theory. But then the part that you probably miss most long-term is some of the literary stuff. And that's sort of the point. That's sort of at the point where I am, that I really want to get really good at the idioms. Because, you know, their language is 5,000 years old, whereas our modern English is at least, you know, post-Shakespeare. So they have so many rich layers of references and sort of allusions and puns that you can have just simply on those sort of rich wealth of literature.
You wound up going to Harvard. Whose idea was that? Yours? Your parents?
I think it probably was mine. And I think it was probably mine from like a really young age. I mean, I think I went to a public magnet school in New York City, which was great because the kids were really smart, but they were very middle class and sometimes working class. Because if you were fairly wealthy, you would actually be siphoned off to some of the most exclusive private schools in America, you know. And the school actually goes nursery all the way through 12. It's called Hunter. So it's Hunter College High School, Hunter College Elementary School. And I even remember being like in third grade and hearing about something back then was called the Westinghouse Science Project, which is this, you know, now it's called Intel. And hearing, you know, you'd always hear about these winners. And I remember thinking third grade, I was going to do one. And eventually I ended up being a writer. So I took ironically, a much more literary path through the end of my high school years. But because it's sort of in the culture of your peers, even from such a young age, you're like, oh, I will go to Harvard because that seems to be the thing to do. And, you know, my parents were totally into it, too. And it's good because it's close. I mean, my parents wanted us to stay within 5 hours driving distance of home because they had like some horrible example of a friend of ours who, you know, she went to Caltech and then she got into this car accident and then it was the weekend of the big snowstorm, so her parents couldn't get out there for like 2 days. And so it was like this random anecdotal experience of some other family that nonetheless sort of, you know, completely, you know, shapes the opinion and view of my mother. And so therefore I was not allowed to go to, like, say, Stanford.
You said you were thinking about being a writer, but the record says your majors at Harvard were applied math and economics.
Economics, that's right, because I got a whole bunch of scholarships to be a woman who studied like in a technical field. And my first love, you know, obviously was numbers. My dad has a PhD in math and, you know, he does computer stuff. My brother's an actuary. My sister is also a developer. So it's a very quant kind of focused family. And I really loved the way that those classes taught you and the rigor and the, you know, the systematic approach to learning and, you know, the idea of algorithms and, you know, game theory and statistics that really, in a way, were really hard now that I look back. because when I finished all of the requirements for my major, I had, you know, a couple, maybe like a semester left, and I took some of my cores and some electives. And I'm like, oh my God, if you're not majoring in a quantitative kind of area in college, it can be kind of easy and college can be kind of fun, you know, because the thing about so many of these quantitative areas is that you have something due every week. And so you are on a constant treadmill in comparison. If you are sort of a humanities or social sciences major, oftentimes you have, you know, a lot of reading, and then like a really big, you know, 60-page paper at the end. So, you know, the end of the semester is really hard, but it works. Or the other thing is, if you have to hand in a 60-page paper, you just have to write 60 pages worth of stuff. I mean, it can be like mediocre or bad stuff, but there's no like right or wrong. I mean, you might get like a B- or whatever, but your computer program either works or it doesn't, and you either got the answer right or not on your problem set. So it was fun, but I'm glad it's over, I guess is the best way to summarize my experience. And then also as a applied math major, I realize this, which is after sitting through many, many lectures of not great lecturing by professors, I've come to realize that, you know, as a journalist, if I don't understand something, it's not because I don't have sort of the capacity to understand it. It's because this person's not explaining it as well. You know, if I was able to tackle, you know, I don't even remember, like real analysis in graph theory in college, then I have the capacity to understand something that can be mainstream enough basically to explain to our readers. And therefore, it gives you certain confidence in dealing, you know, with scientists or dealing with entrepreneurs, which is nice. And a comparison is my friend who went to law school. She said, law school doesn't really teach you that much. What it teaches you is not to be afraid of other lawyers, which is, which I thought was very funny.
Did you ever think about a career in math or, mm-hmm. or numbers?
I definitely did. You know, in some alternative universe, I would have loved to have gotten a PhD in economics, maybe economic history now. I mean, I think that would be a great thing to say, you know, especially given what's happening now in the United States. I often have a little bit, you know, little kind of pings of that. I briefly thought about going into Wall Street because that's what all my peers who were applied math and economics did. So I went through recruiting, and which is, you know, this week in senior year. Back then it was in March or April, and then, you know, it kind of accelerated to the point where this week had been moved up to October. But after that 1 week of interviews, I vowed to myself I would never take a job where I had to wear pantyhose every day. And so I didn't.
So what was it that turned you on to journalism?
It's very interesting. There are very few moments, I think, that normal people, like, I think the vast population cannot point to a single moment of epiphany. But I actually can. So it was the summer between high school and college, and I did a summer journalism program for minority students, run by Dow Jones. And I was interviewing this boy. He was 16. He was black and he was gay. And because of the way that gayness in the mid-90s was perceived, not only in the black community, but the broader community, he had tried to commit suicide, you know, twice already at age 16, which I just thought was stunning. And hearing him tell his story, I really had this moment where I was like, I could do this for the rest of my life. I can give voice to the voiceless, and I want to tell the untold stories. And, you know, and I just sort of entered college with the focus of a pre-med, but on journalism. And so I spent a lot of my summers interning at different newspapers. You know, back then it was de rigueur. It is, since journalism is what I call an apprenticeship model, almost like a trade as opposed to a profession, right? No one gives you a piece of paper that says you are officially a journalist. Like, you are journalists when people hire you and pay you money to write things that other people read, right? And I did, you know, the Boston Globe, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times. And then after my year abroad in China, I went back to the New York Times. It was a very different time. It was like 99, 2000. So it was very much at the height of the internet bubble, and jobs were fun and plentiful. And I'm kind of glad that I kind of got in at that level, as opposed to now. I will have students who approach me and ask, you know, thinking about going to journalism. And my boyfriend actually sort of berated me. He's like, you cannot in good consciousness tell someone that they should go into journalism now. And I'm like, okay. You know, though, even though there's definitely a time where, you know, you get the standard debate, like, I really want to be a journalist, but my parents want me to be an accountant. What should I do? And back then I would say, well, you should follow your passions. Whereas now I have not come up with a good sort of stock answer to that, those queries.
You mentioned the relationship of the internship to your Asian American identity. You're a member of the Asian American Journalist Association. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the presence or lack of presence of Asian Americans in the journalism community?
You know, I would actually argue, at least at the Times and in major cities, among my generation, there is a very if you just looked at pure, you know, Asian Americans as a lump category, which is not the greatest way to look at it, you actually have a pretty decent representation proportional to what Asian Americans are in the general population and in those large cities. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One, which is, you know, it took a while for people who were, you know, English dominant to sort of work their way through the education system and then, you know, pop out on the other side and, become, and get jobs. Two, we come from more professional backgrounds. And so because our there's this sort of joke in among, you know, the generation of Jewish immigrants that came here between, you know, 1880 and 1920s, you know, the first generation is shopkeepers, the second generation is lawyers and doctors, and the third generation is like school teachers, activists, and, you know, nonprofit. You know, it's because you kind of get this luxury. I mean, this is and it's a gross oversimplification, obviously. And so for us, there was sort of that, you know, trend too, where, you know, my parents gave us the freedom to pursue what we really love as a result of, you know, having most of our college tuition paid for and not necessarily having to think, okay, how do I support my parents in their old age? So that's another reason. And three, Asian, you know, we sometimes talk about it, sometimes we don't. Asian Americans make a disproportionate percentage of the top university student populations. You know, at Harvard, I think they're up to 20%. You know, I think Stanford, you know, last I checked, which was a while ago, was at 25%. You know, UCLA, sometimes they joke, is the University of Caucasians lost among Asians. You know, where, you know, journalism is an interesting occupation in many ways because it gives you a really, it sort of seems individualistic, but you're actually part of these, like, elite institutions, right? The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. And as a result, you know, parents may originally kind of be a little bit like, well, if you really want to, but you're never going to be, you know, as well off as a doctor. You know, they'll usually let you do it. So I would say where you're seeing a bigger gap in terms of the Asian Americans is, first of all, what kind of Asian Americans, right? So, you know, you see a lot of Chinese Americans, some South Asian Americans, but you don't see as many, let's say, Hmong, which is, you know, from Laos, though I think they're sort of underrepresented, Filipinos, certain Thai. So it's definitely clusters around certain demographics, right? Then I would also say that Asian American women are disproportionately represented on local news channels. I would say a bigger problem in newsrooms is Hispanics and Blacks in terms of the coverage. Hispanics, you know, 12% of our population. You know, you wouldn't necessarily know it looking at our media coverage, in part because the language connection oftentimes isn't there. I mean, I think every newsroom should have one or two, you know, local reporters who are proficient, if not fluent, in Spanish. Because so much of America's story right now is in relation to our neighbors to the south. And then, obviously, Black reporters, depending on the city and depending on the environment. I think it's very weird because oftentimes the reports will try to look at numbers in aggregate. You know, like, oh, well, you know, the country is 12% Black and therefore newsrooms should be 12% Black. Except it's weird because newsrooms are divided. It's not one huge big newsroom because if that were the case, then maybe that argument would be correct. But what happens is you have lots of little papers. And then you have, you know, big papers. And so because of the way that the mosaic works out, it's really hard sometimes for the little papers because once they get a minority or I hate that word, but if they get someone who is, quote, diverse, like I'm, you know, diverse into their newsroom, who's really good, a bigger paper comes and sort of snatches a person until they finally get, you know, to a city that they're really comfortable in. So there's oftentimes a pipeline program. But I would say that journalism as an industry is has been, from what I've observed, one of the best in the last 20 years in terms of getting people into the pipeline, you know, with, journalism organizations like the National Association of Black Journalists and the Hispanic Journalists and, you know, high school programs. I mean, they've really done a really good job. I mean, there's still kind of problems overall. You know, you can talk about retention or whatever, but I think newspapers do understand that diversity is not just a function of, like, lip service, you know. But really, that if you're going to cover your community well, you need to have a breadth of experience, not just in terms of, like, what color is your skin, but you want, you know, young mothers, you know, older retirees or, you know, on the way to retiring. You want people who may have had a military background or grew up in a rural place or urban area so that you get a different sense of perspectives. They themselves can project their experiences into the ideas that come into the newsroom. And so it's good to have a range. And also just in terms of who you're going to send into different situations is, you know, is critical. Like if I were to go to Chinatown and report, very different from someone who is, you know, 45 and white and male in terms of how the community responds to you. You know, very different experience in terms of who you're going to send in to report in the LA riots, you know, someone who's white versus black versus Asian. So that's always something that we're thinking about as well.
In the second part of this conversation, uh-huh. among other things, we'll be talking about your book that was published in 2008. I sense that this first selection of music that we're going to hear that I don't know whether to call it a favorite of yours, but that you've selected is connected with that book. Could you explain that?
Yes. You know, I think it's really funny the social role or that chop suey once had in American culture, even though right now it seems almost outdated. You know, it seems very Happy Days and, you know, of a different era. But for many people in America, chop suey was their first introduction to Chinese food. And it's sort of nice to look back at the spectrum of music to appreciate that. You know, how often do you get foods sort of glorified in music?
Chop suey, chop suey, living here is very much like chop suey. Hula hoops and nuclear war, Dr. Salk and Zsa Zsa Gabor, Harry Truman, Truman Capote and Dewey. Chop suey,
chop suey.
Stars are drifting overhead, birds and worms have gone to bed. Men work late in laboratories, others read detective stories. Some are roaming round the country, others sit beneath just one tree. Tonight on TV's Late Late Show, you can look at
That was music from Rodgers and Hammerstein about chop suey, chosen by our guest on Profiles today, the writer and reporter Jennifer Ait Lee. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
After you finished at Harvard, you spent a year at Beijing University. Was that like going home in a way?
No, completely not. Completely not. Never been to China. I remember I got a fellowship and I was so excited because it was the first time I was going to go to China. I mean, it's very different now because, you know, high school students do exchange programs in China, but that was not, you know, the case back then, you know. And when we got close, I pressed my nose to the airplane glass to look down to see, oh my God, it's China. And I couldn't see anything because it was so polluted. I remember that specifically. Now, China is, I mean, now going back, there's a sort of sense of familiarity, but it wasn't. It was very different to me. I'd spent a lot of time in Taiwan because my parents, you know, gone to college there and we had family there. But Taiwan had a very different feel from China, except obviously everyone's Asian. You know, though you could say that about Japan, too. And you know, it's a very different experience. And Hong Kong, like all very different experiences, despite the fact that everyone around you is sort of Chinese-ish or Asian. So it was, you know, it was just a, this is, you know, late 90s. So a very different from the Beijing that we saw in the Olympics. I mean, now I go back to Beijing and I'm like, whoa, you know, what happened to this whole section of the university that's just gone? You know, when I... In the time between when I finished in 2000 and maybe even like 2002, they built like a big highway, you know, right next to Beijing University. I mean, Beijing is just sort of going gangbusters. I traveled across the entire country during my year there. I was studying, quote unquote. But since we didn't have tests and didn't have grades, most of my studying was done in trains around the entire country. And I went to, you know, Kashgar, which is more related to Afghanistan, I would say, than to, you know, the main Han area of China. I went to Tibet. I went to Inner Mongolia, which actually has been more or less kind of Hanified or Chinesified. I went, you know, north and south and everywhere. And that was where I really got my education about the vast diversity of China. And I could see why the leaders were so nervous in keeping the country together. I mean, to a large extent, America has the luxury, you know, maybe because of our manifest destiny sense, that we kind of grew into our space, you know, and sort of, you know, steamrolled people who were in our way. But there's not really that much of a fear of America coming apart, right? I mean, we had a joke after the 2004 election that connected all the parts that went for Kerry to Canada. It was like, did you ever see this? It was like Canada, and it was blue Canada, and it, for whatever reasons, all the states were contiguous. And then I think underneath it says something like Jesus Land. I mean, now we can joke like that, and we can talk about red state or blue state. But fundamentally, in the short term, America is a very stable geographic entity. The interesting thing is China is so diverse. You know, you go to a place like Tibet or Xinjiang, which is their western territories, and you'll see that it's so diverse and so different and distinct from the main Han population, because they have, you know, their own language, oftentimes their own religion, own culture, own food. You kind of wonder, you know, how does this really belong sort of to China? And, you know, China definitely believes it belongs to China. But if you look, you know, you kind of dial back history, these parts are not necessarily historically always been part of the Chinese empire. And I could see sort of the anxiety of why keeping a country together was sort of a priority in the Chinese leadership.
When you returned, you went with your job at the New York Times. What exactly is your assignment there?
I'm part of the next generation of sort of like hybrid online print journalists. I work on City Room, which is a the Metro section's online presence. And we call it a blog, I guess, but it's really less bloggy compared to blogs and more like a traditional newspaper website. I mean, there are certain things that make it bloggy, right, which is that it looks like a blog because it's a reverse chronological recitation of content. So that's one, you know, with a lot of links and a lot of comments. So in that way, it has taken on some of the blog characteristics. But in other ways, it's still very Timesian, you know, in terms of the topics we write about, the standards, I guess. I mean, we're a little bit faster, so sometimes we have to make corrections after something goes up. So I kind of write for the blog. And it's interesting because you have a very different vocabulary of stories that you would approach on a blog compared to the traditional print push model, you know, where I just push something onto your doorstep or onto the newsstand. And sometimes we'll write about things that may not have as much sort of quote significance, but are great because they engender debate and dialogue. So, for example, there was a bill that's being proposed in the city council of whether or not circus elephants should be banned as part of a, you know, larger proposal of whether any wild animal should be used for, quote, entertainment, you know, or whatnot. And so, I mean, we got, I want to say, maybe at this point over 100 comments, very intelligent, very thoughtful kind of comments around this issue, you know, which is not, which, you know, the bill's not going to committee. No one's voting on it anytime soon. So, but at the same time, by putting something out there, you engage readers, you know, who debate among themselves. You can see them referring to each other. And I think that's great, right? You can have the newspaper sort of play a different kind of role as a public square, especially around their communities. So, or, you know, we can ask readers to contribute. We did a story on a book of 6-word memoirs called Not Quite What I Was Expecting, which has become a New York Times bestseller.
Sort of like tweet and print.
Yeah. Even tweetier. 6 words. Summarizing your life in 6 words. So Stephen Colbert's was, well, I thought it was funny, you know. And I just wrote something and I was like, okay, your turn. We got like hundreds and hundreds of people summarizing their life because we have an incredibly talented pool of diverse, really well-educated readers. And we're lucky because most of our comments are quite good. Like, I've seen comments on other sites that are like, oh, LOL, you know, 1-1-1-1-1-1, or like, you know, full of typos and whatever. But in general, we can really spark conversation. And it's kind of sad when you think something should have sparked conversation, but like people don't necessarily have something to say. So you think when you're writing these posts, well, what am I going to ask something at the end? Like, what is it that I want to indicate to my readers that I want them to do? And that's sort of an interesting process. The other thing that's really interesting is coming up with the formats and trying to figure out what works on blogs, right? Because for print newspapers in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, we've come to a pretty standardized set of what works in print. You know, you have like a 1,200-word feature article, you have little, you know, listing blurbs, you have like, you know, the breaking news story, you have like what we call brights or lights, the, you know, 400 and 500-word stories. But so we have these like, you know, sort of buckets. And if something doesn't quite fit into a bucket, you know, either because maybe it's not timely enough or what's the news peg, you know, or there isn't enough, a strong enough character, it can just kind of fall over there despite the fact it's interesting, it's worthy of someone paying attention to. And so now with the blog, you have a different sort of venue where you can develop a new vocabulary of stories to work with. And that's kind of fun. Like right now, actually, one of the big things that we've been doing, you can't do in a normal newspaper, is archival stories. Like I can go back into the New York Times archives, which are basically available and free before 1924, maybe?
Because 22, I think.
22? Well, it should be moving in theory, right?
Because okay,
it's
the
copyright.
Wall. Yeah.
It's the copyright as things fall out of copyright, right? So if it's not moving, you should let me know. And I can do a story about, you know, on the 125th anniversary of the Brooklyn Bridge, which is actually not that key an anniversary. A look back at when the Brooklyn Bridge opened. And actually 12 people died in a riot that first week because people heard a rumor that, oh my God, the bridge is going to fall, right? And back then, you know, it really, who knew? And I went back and just sort of reported it out. And so you have this whole other kind of reporting that you can do that is not about interviewing live people, right? But in a way is sort of resourceful and whatever. So that's a new sort of type of story that has come along. And some people really like it. They don't necessarily comment very much, but they get a lot of search engine traffic after the first initial day, which I've been kind of surprised at. Like I did a story on Edison and the first time he turned on, you know, electric lights in the New York Times. And it's so funny reading the reporter's impressions of lights back then. Because they're like, and the orb glowed, and there was no sight of matches or gas to be found, you know. And you know, I think at the time it might have gotten just a handful of comments, and I was like, eh. But then when I went back and looked at the traffic patterns for that, I was stunned. How, I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know if like they're coming through like, you know, some electric hobbyist kind of website or whatever, or Edison fan site. But we were getting very, very high traffic still on a consistent basis to this post that I thought like had never really hit the radar. And so it's great to see these stories have these huge long tails in a way that it's really hard in a print edition. Because, you know, if someone didn't see your story in the first 3 days, the likelihood that they're going to see it again, except maybe in, you know, quote, microfilm or microfiche, is fairly low, right? Or, you know, on if they're doing this report and it'll come up in Nexus. But here, you know, you can kind of have a pretty good shelf life with a lot of pieces.
I suppose there's an element to it, the famous quotation, the past is like a foreign country. They do things differently there.
Yeah, it's totally true. It's totally true.
Your book, The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, was published last year. I can see a little bit from what you've said where it came from. But what really did stimulate that book?
Well, the main plot line through the book is actually about, I don't know if Indiana is a Powerball state, but if it were, they are.
It is.
I think maybe I would have I think it is. And I think the Indiana Powerball people were not helpful when I was trying to find some of the winners. So about 110 people came in second in the March 30th, 2005 Powerball lottery. And that was a lot higher than the three or four they were expecting. And so it threw Powerball into sort of this tizzy, you know, like, oh, my God, was it fraud? Was this, like, a computer glitch? Did something big happen? And it turned out that all these people, or most of them, not all of them, because there was a natural number of people who just chose those numbers, had gotten their lucky numbers from a fortune cookie and all across the country. And to me, it sort of said, it told me a lot about how vast this invisible network of Chinese restaurants had become and what a normal part of society and just so standard, right? So I set out on this quest to track fortune cookies and where those fortune cookies came from originally. And it actually took me to a really interesting journey, not just of where those cookies came from, but also the true origins of fortune cookies to begin with, which is actually not China. And not even really California, even though we say, you know, common lore places it either in L.A. or in San Francisco. And it actually takes my book, I think, is the one who really first publicized the idea that fortune cookies originate from Japan. And I could sort of almost prove it because I went back to Kyoto, where they still are making fortune cookies by hand. But they are bigger and browner. They're made of miso and sesame. And it was such a fascinating journey. And I know that I had an impact because I took a screenshot of the Wikipedia article before my book came out and said, oh, fortune cookies, you know, come from California. And then this article that I wrote based on my book came out in the New York Times. And within like a matter of like an hour or something, someone had updated the Wikipedia page to say they come from California based on something in Japan. And I was like, I have touched human knowledge. I have impacted the aggregate sort of knowledge in this universe because I've changed Wikipedia. Yeah, that was fun.
One of the main themes in your book is the argument that Chinese food as we know it isn't really Chinese.
The Chinese food and we know it in America is what I would call Chinese American food, which is great, or American Chinese food. I would say most people who come from China, especially graduate students, are somewhat mystified and a little bit horrified by what is served in your average Chinese restaurant in the United States. It is a cuisine that has evolved and adapted to American palates and American taste buds, which is a much more Western kind of thing. And not just like in terms of the taste, but even in terms of the presentation, right? In America, you know, if you look at our food in general and Chinese food, you will never think, oh, my food once like walked or swam or, you know, or flew or ran, because we don't like to be reminded that our food was still alive. You know, we kind of have this Star Trek-ish, you know, view that sort of food just sort of materializes in like maybe in nice styrofoam containers at, you know, Whole Foods or whatever. But in contrast, you know, in China, you have a lot of things with eyeballs on your plate. And it's funny because I'm used to it growing up in a Chinese household. But I'm always surprised, even like my friends who I consider very well educated, you know, totally my peers in so many respects, that are like, oh, my God, the thing has eyeballs. Or they won't do chicken feet or, you know, cow's tongue or pig ear or duck's blood, you know, because it's like, ah, you know. And it just reminds me that there is this divide between what Americans are comfortable with and what Chinese are comfortable with. Chinese people, for example, in general, don't like dairy that much and not that much cheese. Cheese is kind of weird. Like, what's going on with that? You know, even though a long time ago, Americans looked over at tofu. And if you look at the very early writings and descriptions of tofu, you know, in the late 1800s, they call it bean cheese, you know, because in essence, you know, tofu really is bean cheese. And there was this kind of mutual distrust and dislike of tofu versus cheese on both sides, even though to a large extent the process that creates them is largely parallel. This one starts with a cow and the other one starts with soy.
What do you consider good Chinese food?
The Chinese food that I like reminds me of China. And there's – and this kind of goes back to some of the stuff I was talking about. The year for me in China – especially traveling, it was a very sort of sweet period in life, right? Because it was after I graduated from college, but it was before 9/11. So it's this very idyllic sort of like the world is, you know, happy and full of potential. And so a lot of the foods that I have from that era were distinct to just certain parts of China. Actually, pretty hard to get in the United States because we're mostly only certain kinds of cuisines have sort of made the hop. So I like a lot of Muslim Western Chinese foods. There's a huge Muslim population in China. So they're Chinese, but they're Muslim, even though the government considers them a, you know, separate minority. And lamb is a big thing. They do lamb, cumin, coriander, a lot of breads. You know, they soak breads. And eating some of these dishes reminds me of that period of my life, you know, because the taste is such an intimate sense. You know, it's putting something in your mouth. You know, you're ingesting it. Really is a, you know, you taste a lot fewer things than you see or you hear. And as a result, it's so striking, the memories that it will bring up. And so for me, good Chinese food reminds me of, you know, of China, maybe of that era, you know, when, you know, things before a financial crisis, before the war on terror and the axis of evil. And so that's what I like.
Where can you find good Chinese food in the United States?
Well, actually, I would say if you really are in North America, I would actually advise you to head to Vancouver. Which, so if you're in Seattle, you're in good shape. But Vancouver has great Chinese restaurants because of all the Hong Kong money that came over. You know, Hong Kong is like, what, an 11-hour, 12-hour plane ride from Vancouver. And so you have these kind of situations where the family's here, but the father flies back and forth. And so Hong Kong people, one, had money, and two, they were demanding. So great restaurants in Vancouver. But if you actually are in New York City, in America, your best Chinese restaurants in terms of authenticity will be in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. But I will say there's actually one other interesting Chinese restaurant, which is very good in a different way. It's almost majestic. It is a restaurant called Trey Yuan, and it is outside New Orleans. And it's like almost like a palace. I mean, really ornate antiques. It's run by a family of five brothers, and they have Cajun Chinese food. So Sichuan alligator and sweet and sour crawfish. And the food is really quite good. It's you know, not always, quote, authentic, though they can make you authentic dishes, but definitely just a fascinating story there. After the Hurricane Katrina, they just kind of opened up shop when they could and just gave away food to the rescuers and, you know, people who had came through. It's an amazing story. So that's definitely like one of the most interesting Chinese restaurants to stop by if you have time.
What would you say to Americans who think that the Chinese food they are eating is Chinese? Do you think they are missing something, or should we appreciate Chinese American food in some other way?
Yeah, I think you should appreciate Chinese American food in its own thing. I mean, I think all they need to know is that you think it's Chinese, but a Chinese person doesn't recognize General Tso's chicken and doesn't eat beef and broccoli and, you know, sort of horrified by egg rolls, you know, which are big and pimply, as opposed to the svelte, crispy spring rolls, which are actually in existence in Chinese cooking. I think if they just understand that and nonetheless embrace it, they're like, you know, that's great. I'm glad you guys have your duck feet, but I really just want my pork fried rice. I think that's fair. It's just sort of an awareness of it. I think the, you know, the big fear is that it's sort of just a myopic kind of experience of thinking this is Chinese food and therefore this is what Chinese people eat. But, you know, I think that kind of goes down with travel, you know, a lot of travel to China, a lot of television shows, a lot of cross-cultural exchanges. So I think the awareness definitely is broader than it was during the 1920s when chop suey was at its height, because it actually took about 20 or 30 years before Americans realized that chop suey wasn't Chinese. And you go into the old newspaper archives of the 30s, and there are all these articles. They're like, oh, my God, we went to China and there's no chop suey anywhere. Isn't this supposed to be the national dish? You know, and or some mayor who wrote back, I've darn run the legs off of every rickshaw man in China and I can't seem to find chop suey anywhere. And so it's interesting to see those kinds of revelations back then, where I think now you would never kind of get an article that's like, pork fried rice isn't exactly what they have in China. You know, there's sort of understanding that not just with Chinese food, but, you know, burritos aren't really Mexican, spaghetti and meatballs aren't really Italian. You know, and people may take a couple years. You know, like if you were like six, you don't know that. But, you know, by the time you're in your like 20s or 30s, it's not something that would surprise you.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been New York Times reporter and writer Jennifer A. Lee. Jenny, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. We close with more music chosen by our guest. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Two, three, me, fa, so, la, joy. Gonna la, la, love the joy. The look what's new. Gotta la, 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 the ways to enjoy. We do. Gonna la, la, love what new the joy's made of. Gonna la, la, love the joy.
La, la, look, there's bigger chunks.
La, la, listen to the crunch.
Now it's crisper.
Now it's brighter, better taste in every bite.
You'll la, la, love the joy.
We're Beatrice.
Introducing La Choy's Honorable Egg Rolls.
East meets West.
When La Choy makes honorable egg rolls.
Swing, American.
Egg rolls, new from La Choy, in five sociable sizes. For snacks, lunches, buffets, dinners, and a choice of chicken, shrimp, and lobster for hors d'oeuvres.
La Choy makes honorable egg rolls.
Swing, American.
For centuries, Chinese cooking considered only for chosen few. But now...
East meets West, La Choy makes Chinese food. Swing, American!
La Choy introduces frozen chicken chow mein. Look, golden gravy, bean sprouts, water chestnuts, bamboo shoots, mushrooms. From La Choy's new frozen Chinese foods.
La Choy makes Chinese food. Swing, American!
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.